This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 25. The shorter the better. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we have a question from the shortest named questioner that we've ever had on the show. Find out more about that. It's all to do with cricket, as it always is. We have a bowler who's bowling a bit short, a batsman who's worrying a little bit too much about technique, and how do you change and challenge players who are resistant to change? Find out on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to better cricket, no matter who you are and no matter where you are. 30 minutes of audio goodness to help you improve your game or to improve the game of others if you happen to be a cricket coach. And speaking of cricket coaches, all three of us today are doing that exact job. I'm David Hinchliffe. I look after things. And helping me along with the advice is, first of all, the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris.
Hello. How's everybody?
Marvellous, thank you. Yes, still enjoying excellent sunshine here. You wouldn't believe I'm in Scotland, but it's really true.
I'm pleased to hear it. It's the same down this neck of woods.
A mere 30% chance of rain. That's pretty much glorious around here. And secondly, we have the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School, who is at a fixture right now, so maybe we'll be getting live updates from him. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, sorry, just went quiet for a second. I'm very well, thank you very much. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Yes, sir. Were you distracted by something happening? I heard some appealing or something in the background there.
Oh, there was a little play and miss, which wasn't out, despite my boys looking to try and steal a wicket out of it.
Enthusiastic. But,
no, nice start. MCC predictably batting first. They're 18 for one off the first seven. So, good start for us. Pretty aggressive field. Now we've managed to get a couple of men back on the leg side, and so we can hit the stumps a little bit more rather than the heavy offside field, which we chose to start with, to the two lefties. But we're two down now. Wicket just as I speak.
Oh, dear.
So a nice start for us anyway. Two early wickets, which is good.
As you know, if you're a regular listener, I've been coaching at a club here in Glasgow all summer. And it's been going well. However, one of the issues that's come up as time has gone on is resistance to changes. And as you can imagine, that's something which is very common. It happens across the world in different organisations, not just in cricket teams or with individuals. But it has become a question for me as to how I can help players. For example, the first team are not having a great time batting this season. We still haven't had a first 11 50. And everyone is training very hard to try and turn that around, but so far it hasn't happened. And I've been trying to bring in changes, helping people to improve their game and improve their batting, but there's been a resistance to trying new things and a lot of satisfied with doing things the way that they've always been done, and hoping that somehow that's going to change, have a turnaround in form. So it's a minor frustration for me, really. But I was wondering if you chaps have had any dealings with a similar situation and what you did to deal with it.
It's a difficult scenario because often the kind of commitment level or the interest level of the players against the coaches can change, and it can be balanced one way or balanced the other way. But I think as long as everyone's aware of a goal that we're working towards, and then what needs to be achieved in order to earn that, achieve that goal. Then there's a pretty good chance you can sort of lay out the path that they need to take, and if there are changes that need to happen, players can often be able to see that and understand that something maybe does need to change if this agreed goal is going to be achieved. Obviously. Players will often have their own thoughts on how they go about those changes. So you've got to be quite logical and quite structured in not only what you want to change, but the reasoning behind why you want to change it. And it may be that you don't actually have a hard, fast rule of this is how it has to happen. You have to give a little bit of it up to the player, or maybe you even try and feed the idea to the player in the first place and let it be their project so they're leading it, which is often a good way to go. But I think the first starting point is having or ensuring that the greed goal that you're working towards is something they believe in, rather than just being something that you feel is where you should be and the team or players in the team not actually being on the same page.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, we've all faced it, haven't we, when we go into new environments and coach. And I should imagine, David, it's not many that are a bit of resistance to change, but in any group of people that you get together, there's going to be a few that will be less ready to change, I suppose. And we need to get to the bottom of why that is. And generally, there's three reasons why people are resistant to change. The first one is that they will become more receptive once they build up trust, and trust takes time. And building those relationships with those individual people, once that's built, then they'll be more receptive to ideas. The second one is people that they know what they know. They know what's worked for them in the past. And as a result of that, they won't change particularly quickly. So you have to prove to them why this change or this change of approach is going to equal results. And you can use case studies. You can use your work in other environments. You can use the work of others, I suppose, in changing cultures and changing approaches. And by doing that and showing them evidence, they'll come on side. And then the third ones are the people that need to understand, I suppose, really need to understand why they're making that change and what the benefit is going to be for them as individuals. And if you do that, then you'll get them on side. So it's about attacking each person in a slightly different way based on what the reasons for their resistance are in the first place. And once you get through one or two, then the rest will follow, because we're all like sheep when we're in teams anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation that I find myself in, that it's not really any conflict. You know, people aren't particularly saying, I think what you're saying is a load of old nonsense. But it kind of manifests itself in, if you turn up at a training session and I say, okay, let's set up a type of practice where we try to do this, this, and this. And the players say, yes, that sounds good. And then it doesn't take very long for that session to break down and go back to the way that they were doing it in the first place. For example, I give you a perfect example in that if you try and keep score in a net session and then you go off and do a fielding drill and come back, then people have stopped keeping score because they've forgotten, because they just want to bat and bowl. As you said, Gareth, it's one of those things that takes time for people to get used to. They spent so long doing things in a certain way and had success doing things in that way that you have to tread carefully to get the point across, but also not get too frustrated by it happening as well.
I mean, it's such a cliche, you know, the old Rome isn't built in a day, but it's absolutely true when you're talking about cultures. And it's vital that we have enough patience. And also, we don't get really narky when things don't go right as well, because it will be our reaction that they'll judge more than the success of any session or how that felt to them. So if you can keep a cool, calm head, if you can engage them in, you know, we tried that today, what didn't work, what could help that work a bit better, then all of a sudden they feel part of that process. And inevitably, David, everybody will be on side in a very short space of time. Well, I say everybody, the bottom line is, when you've got a group of 15 players, say, in your first team squad, the chances are that you're not going to have all 15 of them on side anyway. And you've got to, you know, I ran a Somerset side that ended up being very successful. But it would be safe to say that if I was to put who was in my camp and who was in not, then there would be a couple of people at minimum who weren't in my camp. Same as when Fletcher was running his England side, there were a couple of high profile players that would have been on the outside of Fletcher's sort of camp of being receptive to all of his ideas. But it doesn't stop those teams from being successful. And any team that says they're unbelievably harmonious and everybody's on side with everything that's going on will probably fall prey to a bit of turmoil as soon as something goes wrong. So You know, be realistic, be patient, understand that not everybody's going to always conform to the ways that you want to do, but that is the nature of team sport, whether it be or teams, whether it be in the business sector or the sporting sector.
And those dynamics are endlessly fascinating, you know, the way that they change and the way that people interact with each other and interact within smaller groups within a larger group, and the way that relationships work over time is you know, it's like watching an ocean, waves on an ocean, isn't it? It changes so often.
It does, and things move very quickly. And I think, you know, this one-day series that England and New Zealand have had is a classic example of that. And I think Paul Farbrace has done a brilliant job with Owen Morgan in developing the group. But the chances are that if he was to take that on and they were trying to keep it going over a period of time, at some stage they'd come up against some resistance internally or maybe in terms of results or whatever. But Farby's in a great position. He's going to be able to contribute to the culture going forward alongside Trevor Bayliss, who he knows really well. But, you know, he's had a short-term real impact. But trying to extend that over a longer term and change the culture over a longer term, it's difficult to manage. And I'm not saying he wouldn't have been able to do it, but he's going to come out with heaps of credit, that is for sure, for this few weeks. But it's blooming difficult to sustain that over a period of time. The great thing, I suppose, is that he's managed to do it. And any people that were doubting a bit, and they must have been, because they still had some guys who were from that World Cup squad, who had some baggage, but he's broken through that. And if I know Fabio as well as I think I do, the way that he's done it is being a really good bloke, but also individualising the way that he's communicated and broken down some of those barriers. And I'm sure if you do the same, David, you'll have equal success.
Yeah, it's tapping into that thing that already exists, isn't it? It's a bit like Darren Lehman did with Australia a few years ago. That he tapped into something that was already there but being suppressed, and it was and he brought it out very effectively. And I think both Farbrace and Lehman did a similar thing, maybe in different styles, but they definitely did a similar thing there, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Right, let's wrap up this section with the yes no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more that the team want to say. First question. The best players enjoy the journey.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. Timing is the size of the gap between making a decision and actually playing a shot.
No.
No.
Third question. Finisher is still an essential role for all teams.
Yes.
Right, let's head into the questions section of the show. It's here that we answer listeners' questions, cricket related, and the best one wins the prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can find out more by heading over to pitchvision.com/academy to see all the details of all the courses. And you can send in your questions by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And the first question this week is from the very short-named A. And A says, I have a 10-year-old son who's trying to learn cricket. However, for the bat lift, when he tries to use his top hand to lift the bat and only use the thumb and index finger for the bottom hand, he has problems. Since he's young, his left arm doesn't have enough strength to lift and move a size 5 bat. Are there any special instructions for young kids who want a bat?
The first thing I'd get from that is why we're specifically looking for this type of grip or this type of hold on the bat. And it sounds like possibly we're trying to teach someone a method of holding a bat or swinging a bat as opposed to letting them do it the way that comes naturally or the way that suits them best. It may be that you found that the finger and thumb grip is something that works specifically very, very well for you, which is fantastic, and it's obviously something you're then looking to pass on. However, it may be that for the person in question that this isn't necessarily the right method, or it's not necessarily the thing that's going to suit them at the moment, and as a result they're not getting the control of that backlift that they might like to get. Similarly, it might be something to do with the bat, and the bat may be too heavy again to go with that style. So what I'd rather do is just say, allow them to hold the bat the way they want to hold the bat and see how that does. And if there are a load of issues that come with that and come with an alternative grip or grip that they'd rather use, then possibly look at those issues and try and weigh those up against the issues he's having at the moment. And if actually there aren't too many problems with it, try and allow him to go with a method that does work for them and lets them pick the bat up cleanly and hold the bat with a bit of control. So I'd put the ball into their court and ask them how they want to go about doing it and how they want to actually do it themselves without the instruction of this is how we hold a bat, this is how we swing a bat. I'd rather let them take over.
Yeah, funny enough, we had the junior training session on Monday this week, we had a four-year-old turn up. And if you want to know about not being strong enough to lift up a cricket bat, then give a cricket bat to a four-year-old. But nevertheless, he got a plastic bat and he started smashing it all over the place within about 10 minutes of getting his confidence up. And I thought he would only be able to hit it off a tee, but in fact, you could bowl it to him and he was quite happily hitting it straight back past the feed. So it just goes to show that if you let it happen, then they'll work out a way of doing it, even from the age of four.
Yeah, I agree with that. And to me, the starting point would be bat size, bat weight would be the first thing. And I'm not sure, but this is, you know, specifically a strength thing in terms of this individual isn't strong enough to go down the gym and all that sort of malarkey. This is a 10-year-old boy who's trying to learn the game. And I would go with the lightest bat that you could possibly find. I'd even, if he's trying to learn the game and he's only starting now, it might be, this is where age grouping up gets it wrong for me. So, you know, if somebody's learning a game at 10, why shouldn't they start with quick cricket and all of those things that mean you're playing with plastic bats? And it could be that in a very quick space of time, if they use a plastic bat and they pick up the fundamentals of picking the bat up properly, and then they start to grow, that they can progress very rapidly up into hardball cricket. But, you know, I would start with a plastic bat, hitting some tennis balls around, learn the love of the game and the motion of the game and how to strike the ball in that area, rather than trying to progress too quickly just because your peers maybe have moved on to the harder ball. It's about putting the game that's appropriate around the individual. So, plastic bats, lightest bat you could possibly go for would be my starting point. In terms of the thumb and index finger pickup, I'm with Sam. It's about individuality, but my starting point would go before that. What format of cricket is he playing? What's been his introduction? Has he mastered using a plastic bat? If he hasn't, then let's get him into that. And let's delay the progression initially to maybe get that massive acceleration once everything falls into place. And as I say, this is the whole argument between chronological age, biological age, and also cricket age, which is how much experience that you get over the early part of your life. Your four-year-old, David, that came to your session is likely to have had a lot more cricket experience by the time we get round to 10 years old than this 10-year-old, for example, who's trying to learn cricket probably a bit later on in his life. So instead of applying a chronological thing and let's get him into hardball and all of that, we should apply a more individualised approach to that. So that would be my starting point. And then obviously we can look at some specifics around how you hold the ball and how to hold the size of the bat, the weight of the bat is the crucial thing.
When I was learning the game, the coach we had at our club was not much of a player himself. I think he barely played any club cricket at all. But he went on a course because he wanted to set up a cult section at the club, and he set it up, and he had a great passion for the game. But the only shot he could really teach anybody was the pull shot, and that actually worked in his favour in that he didn't. He wasn't giving people lots of instructions on the way to play all different shots. The only instruction he gave was to play the pull shot, and then everyone had to learn everything else for themselves. And just the pure joy of growing up, being coached to just try and hit the ball and don't worry about it too much, was wonderful. And he often got. Some gentle ribbing from some of the senior players in that club that, you know, he never taught anyone how to play a drive, but he didn't really need to. And I think pretty much all of us learn how to do it by ourselves anyway. So it just goes to show that the joy of the game is equally, if not more important than getting the right technique and having a high elbow and all the rest of it.
Well, you're absolutely right. So when I first learned to play and had my first structured coaching sessions, I had a guy called John Hilson coach me, and he was the senior coach on the Isle of Wight. He'd gone through all of his coaching badges at the start of probably official coaching. But the first thing he taught us was the pull shot, exactly the same as you. And it was the bog standard back and across, you know, get your feet in,
yep.
You know, 1, 2, 3, hit and all of that sort of stuff.
Yep.
What it taught us was that if we didn't use a bat of the appropriate size that we could manage, we weren't going to be successful. And that was a fantastic starting point for us. So we all had appropriate size bats. We all had lighter bats that enabled us to be able to play shots. And as you quite rightly say, all of the other shots came off of the back of that. But it was wonderful knowing at the start of my career that I could hit quite big bowlers for four at the start. So, and then I could build everything else around it. And some who played against me would say that I only actually did learn that shot and kept it the one shot over my career. But I definitely developed a sweep shot as well, which some would say is just a slightly lower position for a pull shot. But
anything offside, Gareth?
Say again.
Anything offside?
Yeah, leading edges, mate.
Oh, same as me.
Third man.
Leading edges. And actually, slip used to get quite a lot of action as well. They were leading edges.
Second, first and second in the game.
Yeah.
Next question is from Liam. And Liam says, I've recently been promoted to opening the bowling in my team. I always bowl a good line and hardly ever bowl a leg side wide. My problem is that it takes me 2 to 3 overs to find my length. I tend to bowl too full, and so far I've not caused the batsman trouble in the first few overs. I've tried bowling at a stump in the warm-up, but it doesn't seem to make any difference. I always feel like I'm starting cold when I get the new ball. Can you offer any advice?
Well, congratulations on bowling a good line with the new ball. I think one of the things that people find difficult with a new ball, because its characteristics are obviously unique in that game of cricket, because as soon as the ball hits the ground or starts getting whacked about, it's obviously going to change a bit. And there's been more bowlers that couldn't control a new ball in terms of line than those that could. So congratulations, Liam, on that. In terms of length, there are loads of different ways of developing length, and you can put cones down, you can put markers down. David was telling me about this new coaching bag that he's got, which has got loads of markers in, and yeah. you can bowl at those. But one of the best ways I find to do it is to get people to develop their feel, because length often comes from the feel of a ball coming out of the hand, and you know, your release points and how hard you have to grip it. And again, you know, it won't be any surprise that we're talking about trial and error in that regard. And one of the things that we do with people that are missing length is get them to close their eyes just before they've let go of the ball and get somebody to feed back to them where it bounced in terms of length. Not line, but in terms of length. And what that does by shutting off, and Sam's talked about this previously on the show, but shutting off one of the senses then gives you a heightened awareness of another sense, so that ability to feel the ball come out of the hand and land into length. So it's a really good example of how you can do it. It's an extreme one, but it's something that's worked for us in the past. The other thing is to get feedback from people, because sometimes when we're bowling, our perception of length and what is actually happening can be different because of our viewpoint. So again, I would use cover point to give me some feedback if I was bowling on lengths, because obviously they're in a perfect alignment to be able to do that. I'd use my wicket keeper as well. And often when I was keeping wicket, I'd feedback on people's lengths, because when you're hurtling a ball down the other end as quickly as you can, especially with a new ball and you're trying to get wickets, it's not always easy for you to pick up exactly what your length is. So I would question whether it's taken you 2 or 3 overs to find your length. You may have found your length earlier in that piece, but you didn't have anybody to calibrate it against. So they're my two things. You've got practices, which include closing your eyes and getting a build-up of that feel of a ball coming out of their hand. Bowling at some markers, getting some feedback from your keeper and your point, because it could be that you're not picking up on the fact that you've actually just found your length and you're still searching for it when actually it's already there.
Length seems to me a bit harder than line, because with line, you can see what's happening in terms of a bowler's technique, can't you?
Yeah, exactly right. And that's what a lot of the best bowling coaches and best bowlers tell me, is that line is easy because you can see it. Length is more of a feel, and that's why we have to try and develop the understanding, the body's understanding, not our conscious one, of how it feels as the ball comes out. And you talk to the best bowlers. You talk to McGraths, and he said, you know, I just try and hit length, but you know when you nail it, don't you? It's a bit like when you throw, exactly the same. You know when your release point is right and the ball's going to hit the bottom of the stumps, if that's your intention, or if you're going to throw it over the top. And it's developing consistency in that feel. And that's what somebody like a McGrath did all those years, was get really, really good. Practicing at hitting markers, that's what he was all about. And he did it in his backyard, in his farming village, and he's done it all the way throughout his career. But it's developing that kinesthetic awareness.
We've had a few guys who have specifically struggled with length because they are very repeatable in the way they bowl. And they're very aware of how they can adjust length in a minor way by changing their head position, changing their body position, just elevating their eyes and dropping their eyes to try and adjust their point of release that way, rather than trying to do anything drastic with the timing of their release. But they find that when we get onto an established cricket pitch, and by that I mean one where you often find that extra build-up as you hit the square, they find that the ridge onto the square changes their body position. They often find in the first two overs that adjustment of body position or body angle, because of the slope onto the pitch, does impact on their length, and their lines stay pretty good. But the little mound that you get climbing up onto the square is something that they don't have in their net situation or their normal practice facilities, so it's something that's slightly different. So if whether or not that is an issue, I don't know, and whether or not this is relevant to the question, but what we've tried to do is as much bowling on the square in those conditions as we can. I'm sure you've seen the squares that are like that and do create that problem, but if that is the case, I'd suggest that it might be worth having a little look at bowling in the conditions you're going to play in as much as possible, because there will be subtle variations every ground you go to.
No, definitely, Sam, I'm with you on that, and practice at both ends of the pitch is crucial, and practice to right and left handers, because often the forces that the body go through, especially if the guys aren't used to making the adjustments that are required between right and left handers, you know, there's a difference, isn't there, unless they're really mature and they know how to realign their body and what have you. So that's going to have a knock-on effect to feel unless you practice it properly. So you've got to give it a go from both ends. Always practice to right and left handers. Always practice with a new ball and an old ball as well, because again, the feel's different of it coming out of the fingers. So the more that you practice specifically, and it goes back to that deliberate practice thing, the better. And the better your release positions will be, the better your understanding of what you need to do to hit different lengths, and the quicker you'll make that adjustment.
Gareth, in the past you have talked about with batting, there's a difference between guys who bat with chin up and guys who bat with chin down, and the way it affects the way they view the ball. Is there any carryover between that movement type in bowling?
It's a really good question. It's one that's less obvious, because obviously it's a more dynamic thing, isn't it, that we're looking at bowlers running in, whether they're bowling pace or even approaching the wicket slower as a spin bowler. It's something that I'm looking into now. It's obviously easier for us to look at stances, either we're keeping batting or fielding stances, because there's less movement going on. So it's not something that I could give you a definitive on at this present moment in time, but it's certainly something that I'm looking at and exploring presently.
What's your feeling? Do you have a feeling one way or the other, or is it just too early to say at the moment?
Well, I think it is too early to say. My sense, would, based on the other things, would say that there's probably something in it. But I'm not in any position to challenge my own thoughts or not at the moment, because it's something that I'm only starting to look at, to be honest. But it's a blooming good question, and maybe in a year or so's time we'll be able to answer that a bit more definitively.
The Soapbox feature is now coming up on the Pitch Vision Academy cricket show. 60 seconds on the clock and an uninterrupted rant or comment from one of the members of the team. And this week is Sam Lavery. Over to you, Lavers.
What I was going to talk about today is just a simple question that can work for anyone. And it's something that does help when you get players that are a bit frustrated with what's going on, or players who aren't sure what they should be doing, or players who you're not really sure how to communicate with them. And it's just introducing a really simple question, and all it is how can I help? And that's something that I've had a a couple of players recently who haven't really been sure what their direction or intention is, and they've not been sure how they fitted in, or not really been sure how they're going to play a part in a game. And all they've done is just said, right, how can I help? And rather than getting frustrated with them or finding that they're not going to fulfill a role on the side, a simple question has just suddenly opened up a world of conversation, which has been extremely useful, and suddenly has given them a purpose and a role within the game.
And that is the end of the show for another week. Before we leave, we're going to decide on the winner of this week's competition, which, as you remember, is the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And we had two questions. The first was from A, the mysterious A, and his son, who was trying to learn to bat. And we had another question from Liam, who was having a few problems bowling with the new ball and getting his length right. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I really like Liam's one, but I'm going to go with A's one, particularly because I don't think we could get a shorter name than that if we tried. And secondly, it's really important that people have good starts in the game, good experiences in the game, and hopefully the advice about bat size, bat weight, and maybe trying some softball stuff to start off with to get those competencies together will be useful to A and his son.
Yeah, congratulations, A. And we look forward to hearing from full stop next week. There we go, that's even less ink required for that one. Now, Gareth, if someone wanted to get in touch with the show and have their question answered and have the chance to be like A and win the prize, what could they do?
I've got to say, that's the funniest thing you've ever said on the podcast, David. And if anybody wants to send a question in with a full stop, an apostrophe or a comma, then they can give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
Who doesn't love a semicolon as well? That's correct, Gareth, to get back to the point. And you can also send your questions in using social medias. Twitter is one option, @pitchvisionacad. And you can find us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can subscribe to the show by going to your favourite podcast app and doing a search for Pitch Vision Academy. And you'll find us in there. Tap the subscribe button to do that. And if you want to stream the show and get the show notes, you can go to pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link at the top and you'll find all the details for how to stream the show or subscribe or just read the show notes. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas. Quality Tommy Cannon from you, that. I love the straight man humour. That's brilliant.